Let me at the outset thank Professor Cole, Durham, Professor Schaafs, and all other members of the center for having me here and for letting me strengthen my very cherished relationship with the BYU and indeed with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. India, as you all know, is the biggest democracy, numerically speaking, but it is also one of the most misunderstood societies. People here in this conference have been asking me questions which I did not think I would ever be asked, because perhaps in most parts of the globe, India is only identified with its elephants and snakes and charmers. Few are aware that amongst the South Asian nations, India remains the only exemplar of a sovereign nation with democratic institutions still standing on a solid constitutional edifice. To quote one of our topmost constitutional lawyers, Dr. Abhishek Singhvi, he said, amidst the wrecks and ruins of constitutionalism that litter the political landscape of South Asia, India remains a shining exemption. Now, let me add to this only this, that according to me, we remain a shining exception, or we have been spared witnessing the wrecks and ruins of constitutionalism because of our indigenous and peculiar constitutional agenda that we sought to incorporate in 1950. Today, I will just try to give you a brief overview of what the Constitution of India says about the right to freedom of religion and how it seeks to incorporate our international commitments into domestic law. With your permission, Mr. Moderator, may I present a PowerPoint?
Yes, of course.
In 1950s, Donald Smith had concluded a study in India on a very meaningful observation. He said, India is a secular state. I'm not reading this. He said, India is a secular state in the same sense in which one can say that India is a democracy. Despite various undemocratic features of Indian politics and government, parliamentary democracy is functioning and with considerable vigor. Similarly, the secular state, the ideal is clearly embodied in the Constitution, and it is being implemented in substantial measure. Indian secularism is not anti-religious or irreligious. For the bulk of our people are deeply religious. There is a rich vein of spirituality running through our culture, our history, our civilization. In fact, religion is the source of most of our moral values. Though there is no officially adopted or privileged religion in India, and all religions are given equal treatment under the law, but unlike most secular countries, the state is not altogether detached from religious activities of its people. In fact, it plays a role in the religious activities and affairs of most communities. Now, this is the religious fabric of the Indian society. The population of India is about 1,100 million today, out of which 82%, 800 million, are Hindus, 175 million, constituting about 13.4%, are Muslims, 24 million Christians, which constitute about 2.35%, 16 million Sikhs, 1.87%, 8.5 million Buddhists, 4 million Jains, and 65 million others, which according to the Census Commissioner includes other religions and persuasions like the Zoroastrians, Parsis, Jews, Baha'is, and the tribal faith groups. Now, the Constitution of India has a peculiar structure. It is neither federal, some people would call it federal, some would call it not federal, but most scholars in India have called it a federal constitution with a unitary bias. This means we have a single citizenship, but we have three lists of subjects on which the state can legislate. List one, which is called the Union List, on which only the federal parliament can legislate. List two, called the State List, on which only the state legislatures can legislate. And list three, called the Concurrent List, on which both the federal parliament as well as the state legislatures can legislate, but if there is a conflict, the federal law will prevail. Now, interestingly, various issues which have to do with religion are covered under all these three lists. So we can have federal laws relating to religion, we can have state laws relating to religion, and we can have laws on the same aspect of religion enacted by both federal parliament as well as state legislatures. In that case, if there is a conflict, of course, the federal law prevails. To understand the right to freedom of religion as it is given in the Constitution of India, we need to go through the preamble. Part 3, which consists of fundamental rights, and Part 4, which is a peculiar part of the Indian Constitution, which contains fundamental duties which are enjoined upon the citizens. As we all know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the Assembly on 10th of December 1948, and it was declared in terms that everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion, which includes the freedom to change one's religion or belief and freedom to manifest one's religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. India was one of the first signatories to the Declaration. And less than a year after that, on the 26th of November 1949, India enacted and adopted an indigenous constitution spelling out the same guarantees which the Universal Declaration had prescribed. This is the preamble of the Constitution of India, which begins by saying, "We, the people of India, having solemnly resolved to constitute India into a sovereign, socialist, secular, democratic republic, and to secure to all its citizens justice, social, economic, and political, liberty of thought, expression, belief, faith, and worship, equality of status and opportunity, and to promote among them all fraternity, assuring the dignity of the individual and the unity and integrity of the nation." Now, what is interesting is that though the Supreme Court has held that we were always a secular country, but the word secularism was not part of the preamble till 1976, when we amended the Constitution by way of the 42nd Constitutional Amendment to include the word secular and call ourselves a sovereign, socialist, secular, democratic republic. But the Supreme Court says that secularism has always been a part of the basic structure, notwithstanding that the word secular was added to the preamble later. The concept was always embedded in our constitutional philosophy, and the amendment has only made explicit what was hitherto implicit. Now, this was not an inadvertent omission that we did not include, that the forefathers, founding fathers of the Constitution did not include the word secularism or secular in the preamble. This was meant to avoid any misgiving that India was to adopt any of the Western notions of a secular state. 25 years later, by which time India's own concept of secularism had been fully established through judicial decisions, we amended the preamble and incorporated the word secular. As I said earlier, secular does not mean that we are irreligious or that there is a distinction between the church and the state, as we understand in America, or the French ideal of laïcité. All it means in India is that all religions are to be treated by the state as equal, and that the state shall not discriminate against any religion or against any person on the ground of religion only. Let us now quickly glance through the other provisions of the Constitution, which are general in nature, before coming to the specific right to freedom of religion. Article 51A contains the fundamental duties and says that it shall be the duty of every citizen of India to promote harmony and the spirit of common brotherhood amongst all people of India, transcending religious, linguistic, and regional or sectional diversities, and to value and preserve the rich heritage of our composite culture. So the Constitution enjoins a duty on every citizen to preserve the rich heritage of our composite culture and the spirit of common brotherhood, transcending religious beliefs. Part 3, which contains the fundamental rights of citizens and persons in general, can be divided into three parts. One, specific fundamental rights relating to freedom of religion, rights of religious minorities, and general fundamental rights touching upon religious freedom. And it begins by saying that the state shall not make any law which takes away or abridges the rights conferred by this part. And any law made in contravention of this clause shall, to the extent of such contravention only, be void. Now, before coming to the specific fundamental rights relating to freedom of religion, I'd just like you to glance through the general rights which talk about freedom of religion. We have Article 15, which says that the state shall not discriminate against any citizen on the ground of religion, race, caste, sex, or place. Now, what is very interesting in the Indian Constitution is that some fundamental rights are guaranteed to the citizens, while there are some which are guaranteed to all persons within the territories of India. This, for instance, is a fundamental right guaranteed only to the citizen. No citizen shall, on grounds only of religion, race, caste, sex, or place of birth of any of them, be subject to any disability, etc. Article 16, equality of opportunity in matters of public employment. No citizen, again, it's guaranteed only to citizens, shall, on grounds only of religion, race, caste, sex, descent, place of birth, residence, or any of them, be ineligible for or discriminated against in respect of employment or office under the state. However, there is a protective discrimination clause, an exception which says that nothing shall prevent the state from, it should be from, making special laws for the development or protection of the scheduled castes and the scheduled tribes. Now, we came out in 1950, soon after the promulgation of the Constitution, with a scheduled castes order which describes who the scheduled castes are. In terms, it names certain castes as scheduled castes, but it also goes on to say that nobody who is not a Hindu, Buddhist, or Sikh can be included in the list of scheduled castes. So the dichotomy is that if you belong to a particular caste in India and you are a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Sikh, you may be entitled to protective discrimination. But if you belong to the same caste and you are a Christian or a Muslim, you will not be entitled to protective discrimination. Then we have the rights of religious minorities contained in Articles 29 and 30. Basically, these rights give, given to the citizens. These rights give the citizens the right to preserve their distinct culture and to maintain and administer their own educational institutions. And it also says that the state shall not discriminate in granting aid to an educational institution on the ground that it is under the management of a religious minority. And the specific right, which is the fountainhead of all the rights relating to freedom of religion in India, is the right under Article 25, followed by Articles 26, 27, and 28. This subchapter is called the right to freedom of religion. It starts by saying that subject to public order, morality, and health, and to other provisions of this part, all persons, please note it's all persons, are equally entitled to freedom of conscience and the right freely to profess, practice, and propagate religion. So unlike the other general fundamental rights, one, this right is given to every person, not only to citizens, and this gives four specific fundamental rights, this guarantees four specific fundamental rights to everyone: the right to freedom of conscience, the right to freely profess religion, the right to freely practice religion, and the right to freely propagate religion. Next comes Article 25, clause 2 of the same article, which says nothing in this article shall affect the operation of any existing law or prevent the state from making any law, one, which is in the nature of prevention or in the nature of savings clause, regulating or restricting any economic, financial, political, or secular activity which may be associated with religious practice. But in practice, the state has never done this. It has never been able to distinguish between the secular practices of a religious community and the religious practices of a religious community. And B is very important, it's providing for social welfare and reform or the throwing open of Hindu religious institutions of a public character to all classes. This article, this clause, seeks to do away with the discrimination that hitherto existed between various castes amongst the Hindus. There's a very interesting explanation which says that wearing of and carrying of kirpans. Now, kirpans are small swords which the Sikh people in India carry. And it says the wearing and carrying of kirpan shall be deemed to be included in the profession of the Sikh religion. This is the only clause or the only provision of the Constitution which describes in terms or which incorporates in terms a religious practice of any community. No other religious practice has been incorporated specifically by reference in the Constitution. Article 26, freedom to manage religious affairs. Again, subject to public order, morality, and health, every religious denomination or section thereof shall have the right to establish and maintain institutions for religious and charitable purposes. And B is very important, to manage its own affairs in matters of religion. It is actually under this clause that the personal laws of various communities, including the Muslims and the Christians and the Parsis, are protected. And all of them are governed by their own personal laws. The Muslims, for instance, by the Sharia, the Christians by the Indian Christian Marriages and Divorces Act. Article 27 only says that freedom, no person shall be compelled to pay any tax, the proceeds of which have to be used for a religious purpose. Article 28 is very important, and this has been a matter of controversy in India. No religious instruction shall be provided in any educational institution which is maintained wholly out of state funds. So what it really seeks to guarantee in unequivocal terms is two different principles. One, if an educational institution is wholly maintained out of state funds, no religious instructions shall be provided in it, unless exceptionally, if the terms of the particular institution's funding endowment so require. And two, if an educational institution is recognized or even aided by the state, no one there shall be required to attend any religious worship or participate in any religious instruction except with his own consent, or if he's a minor, with the consent of his guardian or his parents. So these then are the specific rights relating to freedom of religion in the Constitution. Now let me come to the emerging challenges. But before proceeding, let me very assertively say that on the whole, the chapter of the Indian Constitution on the right to religious freedom is crystal clear in its meaning and complete in all respects. I don't think it leaves any room for any misunderstanding. At the same time, it also preeminently agrees with the UN Declaration of Human Rights relating to freedom of religion. And I have been given a chit. The emerging challenges, I would just like to point out only two or three emerging challenges. The state has now said, the state now believes that only essential religious practices will be protected under Articles 25 and 26. But who will decide what essential religious practices are? Either the state itself, or in case of a dispute, the Supreme Court. This has actually led to some very weird results. For instance, that the Muslim members of the Indian Army were not allowed to sport a beard, and they went to the High Court. The High Court refused to oblige them by saying that it's not an essential practice in Islam because the president of Pakistan, which is an Islamic country, does not sport a beard. I mean, I don't want to comment on the fallacy of this argument. The second challenge which we are facing today, and which you all must have been hearing about in the last couple of weeks, is conversion and the resultant violence. This is a challenge which the Christian minority in India is facing today. State laws prohibit every... You see, there are certain state laws in four or five states only in India which prohibit every person to convert or attempt or abet to convert either directly or otherwise any person from one's religious faith to another religious faith by the use of force or allurement. Now, what is allurement or what is inducement is really the question. Is equality an inducement? Is the promise to be treated equally, the promise to be educated an inducement? So this is really very subjective. But the Supreme Court has upheld this law. And of course, lastly, let me say that in this aspect, in practice, the state has not stood up very well to the constitutional mandate of secularism. And the most pressing challenge now is that while the common Indian on the street, though religious until recently, was highly tolerant and secular in thought and perception, I am a little embarrassed to admit now that this may no longer be true. But this is not completely without reason. This unfortunate shift has a reason. With the state intelligence agencies who have utterly failed to contain terrorism, linking every terrorist attack to some organization having an Islamic-sounding name, whether it exists or not, question marks are being raised on the patriotic credentials of every Muslim. And the way our media has chosen to selectively report these communally sensitive issues in an effort to raise its television ratings has made things even worse. The growing cult of communal violence and hatred is a matter of grave concern for us. Today, our secular links are being subjected to severe strain. We need to take our citizenship seriously. Unless we do that, we cannot take our nation seriously. And citizenship is just not a matter of rights. It's a matter of political literacy, which cannot be divorced from constitutional literacy. The Constitution of India summons us all to a very mature and responsible citizenship, alive and awakened to its secular call. Ladies and gentlemen, we are standing on the brink of a precipice. Let us beware. The choice that we will make will go forth as our judgment, but as in the famous case of Queen Caroline, it will be the only judgment ever pronounced, which instead of reaching its object, will return and bounce back upon those who give it. As someone born almost three decades after the partition of the country into India and Pakistan, let me conclude by saying that I'm very proud of my multicultural pedigree and the legacy of my grandparents who chose to live in India as a minority in a secular state rather than as a ruling class in a Muslim nation. Yes, many of their hopes have been subsequently shattered, but they never regretted the choice that they had made, and I am happy that they made that choice. I do not know whether secular India or tolerant India, as it was supposed to be, will survive. And I cannot save India from those who wish to convert it into a theocratic state. But the day they succeed, I will lose a certain sense of pride and dignity that I've always had and felt as a citizen of a multi-religious, pluralist democracy. Thank you very much.